I remember just this feeling of, it was just pure joy and excitement, you know, a bit of a euphoria in a sense, you know? And I remember being in that driveway and my older cousin was there. And I always tell this story, but for some reason I was going really fast on my tricycle and I locked up the front wheel. And when I locked it up, the back spun around and I did like a drift.
Oh, yeah.
And my older cousin was like, do that again. So I pedaled really fast and I locked it up and I drift. And he was like, oh, that was so crazy. So he set up these cones in the driveway and he was like, do that around those cones. And at 4 years old, I'm drifting on my tricycle around the cones in my grandmother's driveway.
Yes.
And it was just like this feeling of accomplishment, again, and joy and excitement. It was something that I can share with my older cousin. And at that point in time, he's my hero, right? Like, mm-hmm. he's the coolest person I know. So I want to impress him.
This episode is brought to you by WeWork. Being able to work remotely is a game changer. You don't have to spend time and money commuting, and often you can work from anywhere in the world. But it does have its downsides. It can be pretty lonely working from home, and if you're off traveling, it can be really hard to find somewhere to sit down and work without a sticky table. That's where WeWork comes in. WeWork is co-working space with offices all over the world. They have everything you need. Fast Wi-Fi, free tea and coffee, and loads of desk space and meeting rooms, so you always have somewhere to get your work done, whether that's alone or with friends and coworkers. And with WeWork On Demand, you can book co-working space by the day and meeting rooms by the hour at locations all around the world. Thanks to our friends at WeWork, you can get 50% off your next co-working space booking. Head to we.co/Brian50, that's B-R-Y-A-N 50, download the WeWork app and enter code BRYAN50, that's Brian50, to get 50% off your next booking. Here we go.
What's going on? I'm Nigel Sylvester, professional BMX athlete, Queens, New York native, and you're on Behind the Brand with Brian Elliott.
Everyone, welcome to another episode of the show. Nigel, welcome.
Thank you for having me, man.
I usually ask my guests, how did you get this job?
It was a gift from God.
Break it down. Tell me. Like, let's take it back into chronology.
Of course.
You're one of the best. You're the GOAT.
Thank you.
There have been other amazing BMXers, bike riders before you. We can talk about, how they helped pave the way for you.
Of course.
But you're the modern day GOAT. But let's take it back in the chronology. Young Nigel.
Of course.
What were you thinking about when you were a kid growing up? What did you want to be?
As a kid growing up, man, I wanted to be like a fireman. I think that's what the idea was for me, you know? But I told that to my parents and people around me.
Yeah.
Because I thought if I told them that I wanted to be a professional BMX athlete, that they would like discourage me or like laugh at me or mm-hmm. tell me I couldn't do it or I couldn't achieve that.
And why is that? What did your parents do?
So my parents are immigrants, man, from Grenada. And they came over to the States in their mid-20s looking for opportunity. Mm-hmm. You know, I was actually talking to my mom a couple of days ago and I asked her why she come. And she told me just that. She was like, listen, like I knew I didn't want to raise kids and have a family, even though she loves her homeland in Grenada, because she wanted to be somewhere that there was opportunity that she can provide.
Yeah.
And that's why she came over to New York.
Did they fall into kind of more traditional work paths, like become an accountant or go into law or, you know, work at a grocery store? Like, what did they end up doing when they came here?
Of course. So, like, the mindset when leaving somewhere like Grenada and coming to the States is, like, your kids are going to have traditional jobs. Accountant, lawyer, doctor, nothing wrong with that. But that's just how they define success.
Yeah.
And when my mom came over here, she worked in the healthcare field.
Okay.
And my dad, he was a DJ, okay. which was cool. And he was really into music and stuff.
Creative mind.
Yeah, definitely creative mind. But even both of my parents, like as I was coming up, they were like, go to school, graduate college,
yeah.
and get a traditional job because that's how they define success.
Yeah. And did you do that? Did you?
I went to school. Down? You know, I went to like I graduated high school and went to college for a little bit and ended up dropping out. You know, all throughout my early teen years and my mid teen years, I was riding my bike as much as possible. And again, in the back of my mind, I was like, man, listen, I'm going to pursue becoming a professional BMX athlete. That's what I want to do.
When did you get your first bike? Do you remember that that day?
I remember the first time I rode a bike. So I was 4 years old and I was in my grandmother's driveway. And my grandmother took care of a lot of the kids in the neighborhood. So there were always toys and bikes and things around the house. And that's my earliest memory in life in general was me on a bicycle.
Did Nigel Sylvester, four-year-old, have training wheels, or did you just hit the ground running, like you're doing tricks? And
I had one of those like those plastic tricycles.
Okay.
So like the two wheels on the back, one wheel in the front.
Uh-huh. Little red one?
Yeah, a little red one. Uh-huh. And I remember just ripping that thing up and down my grandmother's driveway.
Yeah.
And I remember just this feeling of it was just pure joy and excitement, you know, a bit of a euphoria in a sense, you know? And I remember being in that driveway and my older cousin was there. And I always tell this story, but for some reason I was going really fast on my tricycle and I locked up the front wheel. And when I locked it up, the back spun around and I did like a drift.
Oh yeah.
And my older cousin was like, do that again. So I pedaled really fast and I locked it up and I drift. And he was like, oh, that was so crazy. So he set up these cones in the driveway and he was like, do that around those cones. And at 4 years old, I'm drifting on my tricycle around the cones in my grandmother's driveway.
Yes.
And it was just like this feeling of accomplishment, again, and joy and excitement. And it was something that I can share with my older cousin. And at that point in time, he's my hero, right? Like, mm-hmm. he's the coolest person I know, so I want to impress him. It was just a really dope moment. And I guess that's the moment that I fell in love with bicycle riding and I fell in love with bicycles.
Little glimpse of greatness.
Early.
I've seen those early clips of Lionel Messi, you know, like he's like this, you know, 2-3 feet nothing, but just like running circles around the kids. And yeah. When you were explaining that first little experience, I was picturing you like, I used to ride bikes a lot too when I was a kid, but
nice.
That tricycle, that's not easy to lock up.
It's not, man.
It's like a unicycle wheel. Right. Like it just, there's no gears.
Right, there's no gears to it. You got to fall all in the legs.
So you got to really put your legs.
Yeah.
So that's some natural skill right there, right off the bat.
So I'm saying it was God given, man.
I was
destined for this, man, you know?
It's foreshadowing of things to come. That's awesome. And then where did that take you? I mean, you know, you probably got a bigger bike after that, but like,
yeah.
Tell me how it progressed.
For sure. Like my curiosity continued to drive my wanting to explore like what I can do on bicycles. Mm-hmm. And I actually remember the first time that I got a bicycle with two wheels. My mom took me to Toys R Us and she bought me this little like red and green and yellow neon.
Mm-hmm.
Had to be like a 12-inch, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Was it like a mongoose or like?
Yeah, I forgot the name of it, but yeah. It was like a little small BMX bike.
Yeah.
And she took it out the car and I grabbed it and I pedaled and I like went left to right a little bit because I was unsure. And then I just took off. Like I never had training wheels,
mm-hmm.
you know, like again, it was just the bike. It was just some type, it was just this connection between myself and the bicycle. And as I continued to get older and started to make board ramps. So I would take,
yes,
I would take an old car wheel and I would take a board and I'll make this ramp and I'll go back as far as I can and pedal as fast as I can and hit that thing and fly.
Yes.
As far as I can. And that feeling, man, it's like nothing else in the world. You know, you being 6-7 years old and you're hitting these ramps with no fear. You're not even thinking twice.
Yeah. It's so relatable. I mean, I think a lot of people listening can probably think back to those days. I did the same thing. We did it with cinder blocks.
The cinder block too, yeah.
Yeah, and you have a piece of plywood and then, then you tell your friends to lay down.
And you start jumping your friends.
It was
that thing for me. It was,
yeah.
You know, like lay down even further back and we're jumping off this ramp with all the speed we can and we're flying 5, 6, 7 feet.
Yeah.
You know, and that feeling was a rush, you know,
yeah.
Like I was infatuated with it. I didn't want to do anything. All I wanted to do was feel that freedom of flying through the air.
Yeah. It brings me back. And then when you said that, I also got this little flash of Michael Jordan flying through the air,
yeah.
You know, like, you know,
yeah,
that Air Nigel. That thing.
Exactly.
That's pretty cool.
Exactly, man. And then from there, man, like the bicycle allowed me to explore my environment. So my friends and I would go on little bike rides around like the neighborhood. It was the thing. Like we'll make like a little itinerary of it. We're like, we'll go to Dead Man's Hill first and we'll bomb this hill. There was like this like abandoned park that was right alongside the Belt Parkway. And for some reason it was like this really cool hill that went down to this flat, and we would start at the top of that hill and ride down. It was thing, we'll ride down this hill for hours, you know, and then we'll ride to the store and get lunch.
Would you have like a little back brake, or did you have a little front brake squeezer?
At that point in time on those bikes, it was like the pedal brakes. So like you slam down backwards and
the
back tire would skid around.
Yeah, skid and like see how long your skid was, like
leave all right to rub one on your pavement.
Feet.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was that, man. And we would go to Dead Man's Hill. We'll go to this apartment complex that we used to call the 8, because it was like this like maze. We'll ride around there and we'll go to the store and get lunch, and then we'll go to the schoolyard and mess around. And that was my summers. It was just on a bicycle, like just in motion, just exploring my neighborhood.
Yeah. Were there other kids that it was like a little posse? Like you guys had like a little group?
Yeah, it was a crew of us, man. It was a crew, man. At that point in time, like this is before the internet, you know? So like going outside and playing with your friends was the thing, you know? That's all we did
the only
in the summertime,
thing,
you know? That was it. So we
was the best.
It was our escape from our homes and from our like from our yards and like our blocks. Like we'll go ride around and get into trouble and explore, you know, see what we can find.
Yeah.
And that those moments just contributed to my love of bicycle riding and all my childhood memories.
Yeah. I'm curious, you know, so I'm in production, you know, I'm writer, director, producer. I care about cameras and mics and, you know, this is the gear that we use to facilitate, you know, what we love to do, tell stories and take cool pictures and do all that kind of stuff. How important is the bike, the gear, you know, if you're a Harry Potter fan, there's this line from Harry Potter, like, is it the wand or the wizard? You know? And so weigh in on that. Like, how important was your bike?
My bike was an extension of me. Mm-hmm. You know, like when I'm riding my bike, it's this harmony of man and machine, you know, and every move is kind of like this this idea that I've seen in my mind that I want to now execute.
Yeah.
Like every trick is something I've thought about for hours and hours on end.
So were you thinking about customizing your bike? Like putting pegs on it, for example, or like, you know, upgrading the pedals or the handlebars. I remember like my first BMX bike, I was kind of ashamed because my mom bought it for me. We didn't have that much money. She bought it for me at Kmart.
Okay.
And
Kmart's a vibe.
You know, but so when all the other kids in the neighborhood have got the Schwinn Stingray.
Okay, that's a classic.
Or the Mongoose.
Yeah, also a classic.
Was, you know, like that was like, I coveted the either the Mongoose or the Schwinn Stingray, but I had the Kmart special. I was a little bit like a little disappointed, but you know, I made it work. Like, you know, I could still fly that bike.
Of course.
You know, 8 or 10 feet, you know, at full speed.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, like, was that a thing in the subculture of riding with your friends, or was it more like, you know, I'm the wizard here. It doesn't matter what wand I'm using.
That was definitely a thing, man. Like having a cool bike was everything.
Yeah.
You know, like I mentioned my cousin a few minutes ago, and I remember as a kid, like watching him have like cool GTs and dinos.
Yes,
and
that's where the GTs.
Thing. Man, it was a thing to have a cool bike before getting a car. Having a cool bike was everything.
Yes.
You know, so it was definitely one of those things that I like looked up to and like wanted to have a cool bike. Similar to you, my parents really couldn't afford it, you know, so like they got me what they could get me, and I made the best with that.
Yeah.
You know, but within that, it taught me to appreciate things, you know, and to work hard, because I worked up and saved my money and worked odd jobs to finally get my first official BMX bike, which was a Mongoose Sniper.
Nice.
And I think it was 1999 I got it, but we had got the 1998 edition because we couldn't afford the 1999 edition.
Sure. Yeah.
But it was still a Mongoose and it was still dope.
Yeah.
You know, it was my first official BMX bike, and like that encouraged, like getting that bike encouraged me so much, and it gave me so much motivation, because I was like, okay, I finally have a good bike to work with.
Yeah.
And it came with pegs in it, and I took the brakes off, because taking the brakes off was a thing.
Yeah.
And I went harder after that. Like
you're balling.
Right. I felt I was there, you know?
That's cool.
And I would never forget that moment. It was all black frame with chrome handlebars, chrome forks, aluminum wheels, 36 spokes, had a bent back C-pole. it was everything to me, you know?
Wow. I mean, have you thought about bringing that back? Like a retro Sylvester, like, you know, like, like a limited edition? That'd be pretty cool.
That'd be super cool, man. Like, bikes have changed since then because, like, the tricks have changed. And, I mean, just the sport has advanced so much that you need a more stronger bike than that now. But from a design standpoint, it could definitely be something that you can retro, you know? So maybe one day.
Yeah. I love that idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember, like, I peeled the old grips off that bike. I cut them off.
Okay.
And I bought me some Oakleys.
Nice.
You know, the ones with the grips, the knobs, you know, it was like real chewy. And I felt like I was upgrading a little piece at a time. Then I got a new seat, you know.
Of course. Those grips are classic, man. Like, a lot of people don't know that Oakley started off making bicycle grips.
Right.
And now they make sunglasses, you know.
Yeah.
But I love that they have that bicycle heritage in that brand. And I've actually had a chance to go to the headquarters and have a whole room like dedicated to the origins of the brand. And you see all these like bicycle grips and images and photos and references. And it's pretty cool.
That HQ is in my hood.
Like, oh, amazing.
I live, well, not too far from there. It's cool. It's like a compound.
Yeah.
Right? It looks like you're in the future.
Exactly. It looks really cool. I went there one time. It was really cool.
Yeah. So who are your influences? You're probably watching... Were you watching X Games and like
for
playing
sure.
video games? And
oh, for sure. Like at that time, Dave Mirra was everything.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like legendary.
Yeah.
You know, and he still is my favorite bike rider ever. And I believe the GOAT of all time is Mirra. You know what I mean? Like Mirra forever, God rest the dead. But I'm watching him. I'm watching Tony Hawk as well. You know, he's just legendary.
Changing like, the game.
Right. Just guys who are killing it at their respective sport, but also outside of the sport. And that's what I always looked at.
Yeah.
Like who are the guys that are transcending the sport, you know? So Mirra, of course, Tony, Animal Bikes and their whole crew, Edwin De La Rosa and Bob Sherbo and Vic Ayala and Benny Sandman, Tyrone Williams, like those guys are New York City legends and BMX legends. But these are the guys I'm looking up to when I'm 13, 14 years old and like mimicking their moves to work on my moves, you know what I mean? Things of that nature, you know? But that was a really amazing time because I would just watch videos and read magazines like as much as possible. And I would go to my local bodega and I'll buy the BMX Plus magazine every month, couldn't wait for it to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll ride up to the store and I'll get it and I'll read it three times and I'll cut out images and put them on my wall. So I would go to sleep looking at these guys on my wall and I wake up in the morning looking at bicycle riding on my wall, you know. I was just so as entrenched in bicycle riding. That's all I wanted to do at that point in time in my life.
Yeah. What was the tipping point? I mean, so you talk about like 1999 was like when you got your first legit bike.
Yeah.
I mean, the internet's 2 years old in 1999.
Right.
You know, there's no YouTube yet.
Not at all.
There's no Instagram.
Not at all.
Nothing. What was the tipping point? Like when you really started to get noticed and you wanted to maybe turn it into a career?
So at that point, it was VHS tapes and then DVDs came after, right? So like the goal was to get on one of these videos.
Yeah.
Right. So
it was handheld, you know.
Yeah. Those VX cameras.
Sony cameras,
yeah, with like the super wide lens.
Uh-huh.
That was it. So we used to like film on those all the time, you know, but that was the goal was to get sponsored, you know? So I would watch these videos and like just study them. Like, I remember one time, like I took this girl on a date, right? And she came over to my house after and my parents were home. It's nothing weird, but I made her watch bike videos with me. Cause I was just like that into it. I was like, look how cool this is. And she was like, I'm over this dude. And like, and she bounced, man. But,
that's funny.
That's how much I was into it. Like whoever would like hang out with me, I would make them watch bicycle videos, you know, and I just applied myself, bro. Like it was day in and day out, much as possible to be on my bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
And then
would your friends film for you or like, how would you set it up?
So like kids in the neighborhood, like my mom got me a video camera for Christmas one year. I was like, only thing I want is a video camera, Mom, please. Mm-hmm. All I want. And she bought me one of those little like mini VHS tape video cameras with like a tripod.
Yeah.
And I remember like that Christmas, I went outside and I set the camera up on a tripod. So by the time I figured out the camera, it was dark outside. And I used the Christmas lights to like light the frame up.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in my driveway just like trying tricks. And then once it got like springtime, I would had kind of like homie cameras. So I would film my friends, they'll film me, and we created like Sponsor Me tapes. Mm-hmm. I would send those out, and nobody ever responded to me, which was whatever, but yeah. I did it, you know, it's part of the thing.
Yeah. Well, BMX, BMX was still early, I feel. Like, you know, it was still kind of disrespected, or at least on the pecking order. Like, skateboarding was really exploding.
Yeah.
And BMX was really cool, but it was not, didn't have the money, didn't have the sponsorship that maybe skateboarding had.
I mean, it, like, at that point in time, it didn't have the money that skateboarding had, but it still had money in it. You know what I mean? You still had dudes like Mira, Ryan Nyquist, Dennis McCoy, Matt Hoffman. Like, these guys are still, like, top of the game.
Yeah.
You know, at this point in time, like, Mira is still, like, driving around in BMWs and living in, like, big-ass crib and, like, living that BMX, like, rock star lifestyle, you know? And there were other guys doing the same thing.
When was that first video game coming out? You remember the BMX?
That video game had to come out maybe, like, 2004, 2005, maybe 03, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
I believe it came out.
So, 04, 05, YouTube comes out in 05.
Right.
And then in the next year after 2006, YouTube sells to Google.
Right.
And that's when it really starts to explode.
Right. Explode, right.
And then the year after that, I mean, that whole time period, it's like pretty lucky, but also like pretty serendipitous, right? Because like you're right there at the inflection point of technology. Because the next year, 07,
right,
because iPhone number one comes out.
Right, right.
And then it's like game on with like barriers to entry with cameras. Mm. Like everything just got like camera in your hand. Videos like right there.
Yeah. It's an interesting time, man, because for me, as I'm coming up and really getting myself out into the industry of BMX is right when you mentioned the internet really started to explode.
Yeah.
You know? And I turned pro in 2006, I want to say it was. Okay. 2005. I think it was 06.
How old were you?
I was 18.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I met Dave Mirra when I was 17. And shortly after that, a few months later, he reached out. He was like, listen, I'm starting a bike brand called Mirico Bikes, and I want to sign you as the second bike rider. And life changed for me at that point in time.
How did you feel?
Oh, man. I remember it was like yesterday. I had a Sprint flip phone, and he called me, and I walked outside, and I walked across the street from my mom's crib, and I'm talking to him, and he's telling me he's starting this brand, and he wants to sponsor me. And if you think about it, right, from the age of 12 years old when I first discovered Mirra, and at this point I'm 18, so the last 6 years I've dedicated myself to bike riding as much as possible, like day in and day out. Every dollar I had, I dedicated it to either was fixing my bike or taking a train to the city or gas money to go here or anything that I needed to pay for that revolved around my bicycle. Any dollar I had, any last cent I had, I put it towards bike riding. And Dave Mirra is this larger than life figure at this point in time in my life and still is. But for him to call me and want to sign me, that changed my life. You know, like that was the dream come true. That was all the hard work. That was the sacrifice that my parents made to come to the States and all the sacrifice and dedication they put into like keeping a roof over our head and food on the table and clothes on our backs. Like it finally, for me, it finally culminated into a moment where this dream that I had, that I told certain people that people didn't really believe and people doubted me on, it finally came to life. And man, it gives me goosebumps just thinking about it, you know?
Validated all your hard work.
100% it did.
That's amazing.
100%, man. But then it was the next chapter just begins. You know what I mean? Like now I have to sustain that.
Yeah, now it's game on.
Now it's right. It's harder to, it's one thing to achieve the goal. It's harder to sustain it, you know? And I look back at it now, I was like, man, I've been doing this for my whole entire life, really, you know, and I've been able to sustain it to this point. And there's so much more that's happening with me that, man, I'm like just extremely like fortunate and blessed. And I don't take it lightly.
Yeah. So weigh in on this because, you know, a lot of people who watch this show, they're founders.
Mm-hmm.
They got their own business. They're entrepreneurs. And they're trying to figure out their path. Some of them, you know, like I'm sure some people watching this are like in school or fresh out of school.
Mm.
And others are like halfway done, but they're thinking about resetting.
Right.
And so what's your advice on this? should you follow your passion? You know, you seem to be like genetically, it was just like hardwired into your body to be, become this bike rider, this pro, this athlete, you know? Is it better to follow your passion, what you're good at right away? Or like, should you like put those feelings aside and kind of do, it's like head and a heart problem, right? Like your heart's like telling you one thing, your head's telling you another. Like, what's your advice on that?
Man, I'm a big believer of following your heart, you know, follow that feeling, follow that, like that voice in your head that's telling you like, chase that thing that you believe in, that thing that you love, that thing that keeps you up at nighttime, the things you think about when you're in the shower, when you're eating lunch, when you're driving, when you're walking, follow that thing, sacrifice everything for it, dedicate yourself to it, you know, be smart about it though.
But why do you say that?
Because those are usually the things that make us the most happiest, you know, and you live one life, right? And what's something I've learned throughout this life, man, is the thing that makes you happy is worth pursuing that thing by all costs and by any means.
Yeah, I would co-sign that. It's when you're doing what you love, it doesn't feel like work.
Not at all.
You know?
Not at all,
man. And then it's what enables you to scale and be, you know, do it for like the rest of your life if you want to, you know?
Yeah, even if you're not making the most money with it, the happiness that you get from doing that thing, it's worth it, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I guess too, you know, it's all about like, what's it for? What's the purpose?
Right.
You know, if money is your number one goal, then maybe what you're good at doesn't align with that goal.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's a better way. If like money is like, hey, my only goal is to make the most money I can, then maybe that doesn't always align. But it's like, if I want to be happy, if I want to feel fulfilled, if I want to be like, you know, energized, light up,
right?
Then you got to focus on the thing that does that, right?
Hell yeah.
I hope that money is a byproduct of that.
Hell yeah, usually follows.
Not always.
Yeah, always, but usually follows. Like the other day, I wrote this thing on my hand and I posted it on social media. I wrote, create dope shit and the money will follow. And that's something that I live by, you know what I mean? Like that's usually how I approach a lot of things in my life. It's like, I just want to create a dope product. I want to make something that's going to affect people, that's going to evoke emotions, going to educate people, enlighten people.
Yeah.
And throughout my life, I've continued to do that and the money has followed.
Yeah. Let's talk about your brand for a second. So this series is called Behind the Brand. Mm. The whole purpose, the whole reason I started this series is to help people grow their brand. When I first started my production company, I started it kind of arguably at the worst time in history. I started at 2008. There's a recession happening.
And housing crash and all of that.
All of that. So like best laid plans, everything was like wiped out immediately. And I felt kind of this panic moment like, uh-oh, do I really know what I'm doing?
Right.
And so I instinctively started reaching out to people who had like weathered storms and been there and done that. And people who are much smarter than me. And I started asking them, what do I do? How can I be successful? And so that's how this whole series started a decade ago. But it's really evolved into helping people to build their brand, whether that's a personal brand or you know, a company with a product or a service. So let's talk about the Nigel Sylvester brand.
Right.
First of all, how do you look at brand? Like, how do you define what a brand is? And then, like, what's the Nigel brand?
That's a good question. How do you define what a brand is? I feel a brand is it's the idea that you create, and it has a point of view, you know, and it's something that people come to trust and know that the product that you're delivering to them, it stands for something. It means something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I look at my brand, when people interact with my brand, I want them to know that they're getting something that's thoughtful, you know, that's considered, that's going to push the bar. I want to inspire them, motivate them.
My mentor, Seth Godin, talked to me about branding a lot. Mm. And he reminded me that, you know, a brand is kind of like a shorthand for what you stand for.
Yeah.
You know, it's not your logo. It's not the color or the font or the, you know, it's like brand often lives or always lives in the hearts and minds of other people who have an experience with you. Like you know, you can maybe like tell people what you stand for, your values, and then hopefully you can walk that talk. But ultimately, it's other people that get to decide right. what your brand is based on their experience.
Right.
And it, you know, if it tracks from the energy that you put out, then that's, I think, how things grow. But it's like a shorthand, mm-hmm. you know. Talk to me about how you have grown this brand. You've got this really great necklace on.
Oh, yeah, Go.
Yeah, talk about Go and how that kind of, that's become a little sub-brand of yours, and that's grown. You've got a book out.
For sure.
You've got this collection of videos. Talk about Go.
Yeah, so Go started in 2015, and I was at this place in my career where I wanted to create a content series and build like a content franchise, something that I can channel all my different interests, whether it was bike riding, traveling, fashion, art, and my community of super creative friends, just like everything that I was touching at that point in time. I wanted to create a platform that can highlight those things. So Harrison Boyce, my creative partner, and I started to brainstorm different ideas and do some research, like kind of see what was in the marketplace and what's something we can create that hasn't been created yet, something mm-hmm. that's brand new, something that's fresh. And we took the entire summer of 2015 and we developed this video concept. And it was like, man, like, we think we got something here, right? So like, let's like really flush it out. And that's what we did. We flushed it out. And at the end of the summer of 2015, we had the first Go video, which was Go New York. And at that point in time, it wasn't even called Go yet. It was just, we just had the video done. And I was like, man, like, how do I name this video? You know? And I was like, what's something that like, if it succeeds, we can continue moving forward with it.
2015, and wasn't that like the big storm year in New York? Wasn't that like,
was when it a storm? I'm not sure. Maybe like white coat.
Tons of
winter
snow.
Winter storm?
Yeah. Like,
maybe, I'm not sure.
It was like, you know, I remember this Casey Neistat thing where he was like snowboarding through.
Oh, we sold it onto the back of the car.
Yeah.
I think it might be a year later or something like that.
Okay. Just trying to get the context of the timing. Yeah.
Right. I think it was like a year later, actually.
Okay.
So we put this to like, it's like, no, I'm going to call this video Go. Because pretty much once I take off from like my first destination in the video, I don't stop. I'm just mm-hmm. going the whole entire way.
Yeah.
So like we put the video out and didn't have a marketing plan for it, didn't have a brand plan for it. We just put it on YouTube to see what would happen.
Yeah.
And the video went viral. It went crazy.
Yeah.
And within a matter of weeks, there were different publications and websites and media outlets contacting us directly. Like, yo, can we post the video? Can we talk about the video? Like mm-hmm. all these different things. And it was my first video that I did that hit 1 million views.
Awesome.
Within a few weeks. And I was like, damn, this is sick.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, well, let's continue to do these around the world. And we shot them in a way that each video was like a cliffhanger each video ended in a cliffhanger. Mm-hmm. So that once we completed the series of me going around the world doing these videos, you can put all of them together mm-hmm. and you can watch me start in Queens and mm-hmm. ride my bicycle around the world and end back in Queens.
Smart.
And as we started to do more and more of these videos, the brand started to grow. Like people were like they started to relate to the energy and started to reference other things as like a Go video, you know? And throughout that process, I was like, man, well, we need to do some merch. Like we need to start making some product, you know, like let's create an access point that people can embody the energy and embrace the brand beyond just the video on the screen or on your phone.
Yeah.
And we made some tees and started selling those and people started to buy them.
Yeah.
And started to do other collaborations, did the collaborations with United Arrows in Tokyo, did a collaboration with Levi's, and most recently did the book with Rizzoli. But it just started to catch like wildfire and had like this ripple effect where the initial idea was just wanting to create a video platform. And now we have a full brand that is focused on content, it's focused on merchandise and live events. Mm-hmm. Which we did an event last year called Go Ride. And I wanted to celebrate World Bicycle Day by doing an event that we can galvanize different bicycle communities around the world. So we decided to do a bike ride from London to New York in under 24 hours.
Wow.
Which was super cool. And we had hundreds and hundreds of kids come out between London and New York on June 3rd of last year, and I was in both cities in the same exact day.
How did you get the word out? Did you just post it on Instagram?
On Instagram, or? Man. So, yeah. Social media, Instagram, okay. Twitter, Facebook, and events like that, like kids within the bicycle community, within the culture in general, they're just going to share that. Mm-hmm. You know, like they know it's going to be a marquee event of that summer, and they want to pop out and feel the energy. And that's what we did. And it was incredible, like riding, like being able to ride my bicycle on two different continents in the same exact day and connect with these kids. And just,
it's wild. Like you could, that, I mean, it's what, 12-hour plane ride from here to London, right?
Oh, it's less than that.
Oh, is it?
From London to New York, it's probably like 7 hours.
Oh, okay. That's not bad.
Yeah, it's not bad at all.
Man. Oh, I'm thinking about L.A.
Yeah. I used to go from L.A. to London.
A couple more hours.
Yeah.
Still amazing. Bad.
No, it was really cool, man. It was really cool, man. Again, that was a prime example of the power of bicycle riding, mm-hmm. where we're able to use this bicycle as this common thread to connect with two different communities the same exact day and doing the same exact thing.
Yeah.
And share the same love and passion for bicycle riding.
Well, I 100% can see how the bicycle was the common denominator, but it's also you.
That part.
Like you are the connector, mm-hmm. you're the conduit, you're the, you know, like you had this movement happen.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this old movie called Forrest Gump where like you know, Forrest starts running.
Yeah.
He's just a solo guy.
Yeah.
You know, and then all of a sudden he's got a couple of people following him. Before mm-hmm. you know it, there's a whole movement.
Right.
It's a movement. And that seems like what happened with you and bicycles.
Yeah.
You like I said, galvanized.
Mm-hmm.
You brought people together.
Yeah.
The bike was just the medium.
Yeah.
You know, but people, what they really wanted, I'm guessing, is community.
Hell yeah.
They wanted to like hang out with people who are like-minded.
100%.
Right? People like us do stuff like this.
Yeah.
You know?
Definitely. It's about bringing that community together. It's about bringing like minds together. Because mm-hmm. once you bring those like minds together, other ideas spark from there. It's about a sense of belonging.
Yeah.
Right? A sense of relatability. You know? And that's for what I strive for within my personal brand and also the Go brand. Is to create a platform that like minds can like come together and exchange information, exchange ideas.
Yeah.
You know?
So as we zoom out on that idea, I think that's a super good business lesson for anyone who's like building their thing, whatever mm-hmm. their thing is. So it's like, you know, your playbook was, okay, the bike was the medium.
Right.
But the fundamental principles of that were like, you know, bringing people together, like-minded people who wanted to hang out, who had similar interests or culture or background, wanted to hang out with each other. Like, so what can you do in your industry, your field, your product, you know, to galvanize people? You know, it could be around food, could be around, you know, or fashion, anything. Could be around music.
Mm-hmm.
The medium doesn't matter as much. Ultimately, it's about the people, right?
Right. Of course, it's always about the people.
Yeah.
Always, man. And for me, it's just sharing my POV,
mm-hmm.
you know? I feel there's so many people in this world that have a similar POV or can appreciate my POV.
Yeah.
The same way that I appreciate other people's POV, and I use different brands every single day. I embrace different brands because of what they're projecting out into the world.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's a good example, too. You talk about, you know, music, you talk about fashion, like, you know, we're multidimensional people.
Yeah.
You know, when we get off our bike, we like to put on, you know, some bling. We like fashion.
100%.
Or, you know, you're a handsome guy. I'm sure you know, worry about your hair because that's the thing too. It's like, it's something just to consider, like for people who are trying to build their companies. It's like, it's not just one dimensional. Like,
not at all.
Your people are also doing other things, not just one. Right. There's lots of other areas to connect them. As a filmmaker, I'm curious too, like how you made those Go videos. Was it like with like a 360 cam or like?
No, just a GoPro.
Just a GoPro.
Yeah, just the GoPro.
How many people on that shoot though? Are on average?
Three.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's you with a bike. Did you have like a GoPro on the front or like on the back? Or?
I can't tell you I put the GoPro, but it's a GoPro on my body and me on a bike, and I have my director. He has a live feed.
You can't tell me because it's top secret?
Yeah, of course it's top secret.
Yeah. I feel like you maybe wore that mouthpiece.
No, I don't wear a mouthpiece.
That's terrible, right?
I couldn't because they also hear me talking throughout the video.
Oh, right.
So it couldn't
be
a mouthpiece. But no, there's a camera on my body and we move it depending on the shot.
Yeah.
Have my director who has the live feed, because when we're, the interesting thing about the Go videos is when I'm shooting them, I can't see what I'm shooting.
Right.
Because the camera's on me.
Right.
So it's all about a feel.
Right.
You know, which is, it's an additional challenge in executing and making that, like that film.
For sure it's a challenge, because you're riding towards the camera sometimes too. And it's like.
No, the camera's on me the entire time.
Right. I'm just saying, like, there's different perspectives.
Oh, 100%.
Right? So it's like.
100%.
It's like a first person shooter game.
Yeah.
Right. And so.
So it's all about a feel of like, so sometimes you have to shoot a clip multiple times.
Yeah.
Because I got it wrong, or my body was in the wrong position, or my head was in the wrong position.
Oh, I see. So you had multiple takes.
100%.
Yeah.
Like, it's funny because sometimes people think we shot the video in one day. Like, nah, thing took 3 weeks.
Okay.
To shoot that.
I wanted to know that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. They usually take about 3 weeks of shooting and then another like 2 weeks of editing.
Okay. That makes me feel a little
process.
Bit better.
Nah, it's a process for sure.
I was like thinking you did it like one take.
Nah, I wish.
Wow.
I wish, man. But that's the thing about it too, that people don't know. I'm so involved in like every part of my brand and I enjoy it, right? Like, I enjoy the process of ideating and brainstorming.
Are you guys doing like storyboards and all that? Like
100%.
Oh,
storyboard
really?
We storyboard every shot.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, I have every shot on paper.
How sophisticated is it? Like stick figures, or like you have an artist? Like,
no, we have proper like images that we go out and we'll scout locations and shoot a photo and then draw over those photos.
Mood board.
Yeah,
whole thing.
We'll do test shots, mood boards, and a lot of it's timing patterns too. Because like some of the shots, I'm riding and I'll jump over a table, then I make a left and then I'll go under something and I'll run into something else. So all of those are like timing patterns that I have to remember. Like, it's like a play in a sense. It's like a football play, a basketball play.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have to remember each key moment of the play.
All this is making me feel so much better.
Why?
Because it looks so complicated.
Right.
And so like surgical.
Right.
Like so planned out.
Uh-huh.
I'm glad to hear that it actually is.
You know, it definitely is.
Because like if you just rolled through and like, you know, one take, two takes, like
nah,
I would be like, how are you doing this?
Yeah, it's definitely planned out, man. But like, I just enjoy that process of creating.
But I respect that so much because I know how much work goes into that.
Right.
So the fact that you're storyboarding that and you're thinking through, you know, the cadence and like, you know, you turn this way and the camera turns this way. Right. Like, it doesn't make sense to flip it rack around this way. It's like, you want to go with
100%.
All that kind of stuff thought out in filmmaking.
Yeah. It's part of filmmaking,
it's
right?
It's part of it. Yeah.
And sometimes you get a shot, you go home and you look at it and you need to go back and get it again because you didn't get it the right way.
Yeah. We call
you
those pickup shots.
Exactly. Definitely have pickup shots. Sometimes I've had to go back to a city or go back to a country to go get a pickup shot.
Are you serious?
Yeah, man. It's part of it, you know?
Back to Barcelona, guys. Let's
right.
Go.
Got to go back to Vegas to go get a shot.
Yeah.
You know? It's just part of the game. You know, film, that's just part of it, you know? But I enjoy all of that.
I'm just thinking maybe, like, you ought to find a body double.
I should. Someone that has the same, like, skin tone, man.
Maybe AI with the, you know, advancements in the AI. We
nowadays,
can replicate. You know, a Nigel lookalike, at least from like, you could have like a zoomed out shot, like seeing the distance and like.
And trick some people.
Trick. At least as a filler.
Right.
You know, no,
I get
pick
it.
Up.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, listen, like that, like that's something like that I've learned right through my experience of creating films and video projects, you know, like, that attention to detail is so important. And that goes into branding as well. Like when you're building a brand, when you're creating anything, like you want to pay attention to those details from the very beginning because you missed something here that's going to come bite you in the butt later and you don't want to deal with that.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot. In fact, I got asked this question last night at dinner, like, because I've done interviews like over 500 with some of the smartest people on the planet, the most creative people, some amazing talents. And someone said, you know, what's the throughput? Like, what's the common denominator? And there's a lot of answers that run through my mind, but the one that came up first was there's these successful people have a certain level of taste that we don't have or that maybe, you know, in their particular field, it's a high level of taste. So it could be, you know, a designer, could be an athlete, you know, chef, musician, whatever it is, but they're like the way they see the world, their POV, their taste level is different than ours.
Right.
And that's why they're cut above.
Of course. I mean, I feel like it's that. I also feel it can just be an extreme work ethic.
Yes.
You know, like who's willing to work the hardest? Who's willing to go that extra mile to bring their idea or to bring that thing that they are super passionate about to life?
Yeah.
you know, and I feel like that's part of my success, right? Is that I'm going to stay up those extra hours and I'm going to like dedicate the time to bring the things that I'm passionate about to life.
Yeah. When you're saying that, I got this flash, you know, that iconic Ali photo when he's standing over.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, I've seen it with a quote under it, which is like, you know, he said something like, I hated every single day of training,
right?
But like, it was so worth it. Like
100%.
You got to put in the work. You got to have the discipline.
Discipline. I was going to say discipline. That's a big one, man.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, they come short of their goals or their dreams, or they fail because they lack discipline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, doing the thing you don't want to do over and over and over and over again and staying locked in. Like, that can make the world of a difference.
Yeah. And I've seen you guys, you know, your type of athlete where you practice this trick over and over and you're falling and you're, you know, getting scraped up and you're breaking bones, or, you know, it's like, but like those BMX guys, you just keep going until you perfect the trick.
Yeah. And
it's incredible.
And BMX taught me, wanting to be great at BMX has taught me discipline, you know, because there are times where I'm chasing a trick for weeks or months, or I have to go back to a state. Yeah. 5-6 times to land one trick.
It's not without consequence.
It comes, you know, with bruises, and it comes with setbacks, and it's a financial commitment. It's all these different things.
Mm-hmm.
But the discipline to stay locked in until I landed that trick, right? I applied that way of thinking to the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I approach every aspect of my business with a similar discipline, you know, and I contribute that to my success up to this point in my life.
I mean, we were just sitting back, you know, chopping it up, reminiscing about the good old days and all that, you know, tracking my roots, where I came from and where I'm going. But like I say, man, always said it, it's not about the destination, it's all about the journey. Ain't nothing changed but the weather. The dangling carrot, it hang from the rear view. Uh-huh. Your dreams in the past ain't nowhere near you. Backseat drivers got nothing but 2 cents. Shotgun riders too biased, they all liars. I should get an A for effort, I'm too tired. But I'm never giving up, that's why I'm kinda admired. Role model, like it or not, I gotta play it. Sugarcoat the rhyme sometimes, but still say it. Said I was quitting at 40, it's just a fib. I'm still a kid that's wiping the food off of my bib. You ever wanted something so bad that you could taste it? Cried over every opportunity wasted. Good and bad news, which one you want first? Either way you pick, the bad still gonna hurt you the worst. I never got to bask in the fruits of the labor, and I never got the cash from that dude from the label. I'm just thinking back. Retrospect, I would've did it the same.
Uh-huh.
In hindsight, I'm the only one to blame. I ain't picky, I'm just real specific. I want nothing less than terrific. I know y'all get it. I'm aggressive, so our style is clashing. Killer instinct, and I play with passion. I'd rather be hated for being one of the realest than get a lot of love for these overrated appearances. I can stand on skill alone, but I'm a package deal. I can write the whole song and rap for real. I got my head in the cloud with a pun intended. I don't need to see nobody, I don't want no visits. Introverted, I just flirt with the music. Small circles, how I choose it. Stay away from squares, they the one that look like a L7. I've been doing this since I was 11, and the shit gets real. Time for the children. Now you can boo me, jump off, I'm winning. I still love you though, shout out to the women.
Wash, you was cool, they was acting wild. Walk in, leave drunk, it was packed for aisle. Belligerent students, man, the shit got messy. Remind me of my first show I did at the Red Sea. Ain't had no DJ, just the tape deck. Opened up a Son of Star Child, I love that. Met this cat named Larry, he was with the Avengers. Showed me how to make moves and walk with the winners. Soon went to the pen, I never seen him again. But I did a couple shows with his friends. Lumberjack, Brown Clown, so-and-so, and Dude with the Orange Pants. 10 years later, now I'm rocking the Orange Pants. But they Jabos though, okay. You know. Fresh to death, yeah. Always and forever. Don't get it twisted. Number one listed. Nitro with the nice flow. You know. It is. Take a picture, baby. It'll last longer. All in your mouth. Yeah. In retrospect, I'm just thinking back to the time when it was all good. The golden era.